Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we're talking about immigration and migration. The Syrian refugee situation has become even more controversial in light of the Paris attacks.
In regards to what happened in Paris, these guys are posing as Syrian refugees. And until we are certain that process is adequate, we have to be very careful.
But there are some Syrian immigrants already in Appalachia. We'll hear from Nehruz Ketreb. She hasn't been home to see her parents in 4 years.
It's different when you're away and you don't know what's going on exactly. It's really hard because you start imagining things.
And we'll hear the story of what happened to Appalachians who migrated to Chicago in the 50s and 60s.
We kind of got a little bit of a shock when we moved to Uptown because there were many, many Southern people there. But they weren't the Southern people that, like, we were used to being around.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia.
I ain't got a place. I ain't got a place in this world. I ain't got a place. I ain't got a place in this world, I know.
Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, we're talking about immigration and migration and Appalachia. Central Appalachia at one time was considered the promised land for folks from other countries. They came here from Ireland, Poland, Greece, and other parts of the world looking for work, mostly digging a hole in the ground. Now, as coal jobs decline, many people are migrating out, not in, to find work. Population has been declining in parts of the coal fields for years, and later in the show we'll hear a story about what happened when Appalachians moved to Chicago looking for jobs. But first, we're going to talk about immigration or folks moving into the region. In the wake of the recent terrorist attacks in Paris, many politicians want to prevent Syrian refugees from coming to the United States or put more restrictions on Syrian refugees coming here. The Federal House of Representatives recently passed a bill that would require extra security measures to ensure refugees hoping to enter America from Iraq and Syria are not a threat. The bill requires background checks and approval from the Secretary of Homeland Security, the head of the FBI, and the Director of National Intelligence on every individual refugee from Iraq and Syria. Obama has threatened to veto the bill, but at one time lawmakers threatened to attach the language to a spending bill that's critical to preventing a government shutdown. There are many Syrian immigrants who live here in America already. For some in Appalachia, just staying connected with their family back in Syria can be a challenge. And as it happens, a fellow working here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting has a roommate who is Syrian. Ikram Binasha, a student at West Virginia State University, has seen how tough the last few years have been on her roommate, and she wanted to share her story.
For 26-year-old Nehruz Ketreb, making a phone call to her family is not as easy as it is for the rest of her friends in South Charleston, West Virginia. Today, Nehruz wakes up with the same fear, hoping that her family is doing well. She picks up her phone and dials her mother through a smartphone app. Often, like today, the internet connection in Syria is hit or miss. After several attempts to reach her mom, the phone finally rings.
مرحبا ماما.
كيفك؟
الحمد لله كيفك انت؟
She asks her mom repeatedly, "Do you hear me? How is everyone doing?" She barely hears what her mom's saying. Then the call cuts off.
I've got a lot of memories, like when I was a kid playing with everybody. We never had any problems like, okay, these are neighbors, like I have to stay away from them or something. No, it was just fine. I mean, I don't know.
Nehruz is my roommate. You just have to look deep in her eyes to know how much pain she hides. 6 years ago, she crossed the sea to pursue a bachelor's degree in biology at West Virginia State University.
Do you still have family in Syria?
Yeah, my whole family actually there. My parents, my brother and sister are there.
Nehruz is now an American citizen, but her parents are still living in Syria, in her hometown of Salamia. Salamia comes from the Arabic word salam, which means peace. It's a small town of about 66,000. They haven't seen much conflict there, but of course, in a civil war, the threats are very real.
It's pretty hard. I mean, it's really, really hard. I talk to my parents like twice a week, three times a week, whenever they have electricity. That's the first thing. I mean, you know, sometimes they don't have electricity, they don't have water, so there's no communication with them.
One of the things she misses the most is the sound of her family's voices. She's a big fan of Syrian soap operas because it makes her feel connected to her home. Two years after she arrived, the Syrian war started. She still remembers clearly the so-called Arab Spring of 2011, when she first saw Syrian protesters being killed on TV. She recalls how she got up and slowly walked to the window and rested her head on the glass.
I remember on that day, I looked in my window and I was looking to the sky and I was saying, would this will be happening until next week? And now it's been almost 5 years.
Since then, she stopped watching the news, but she still wanted to help her people. After the protests, her friends and family weren't able to use social media.
They have like some problems with the internet because they will cut the electricity, so they can't publish anything and the world will not know.
So she created a Facebook page to report the updates and photos that she was receiving from nonviolent protesters back home in Salamiyah. She was posting from her apartment in South Charleston, while her friends back home were in the middle of the conflict. Nehruz says she felt insecure being away from her family, that in 2012, after a year of the Syrian conflict, she decided to take a semester off and go back home.
I didn't care about, like, there's war, there's people are dying. I just wanted to be with them.
Being with her parents for 3 months made her feel motivated to come back to West Virginia to finish her studies. She also stopped helping the protesters on social media. She lost touch with many of them, but she still posts her own thoughts and poems onto Facebook. She is against the Syrian government, but she is also against ISIS.
Because they're not doing anything different from what the regime is doing. They're killing innocent people. They are very extremist. I don't call them religious people because they're not. There is no religion that says if somebody did not do what we're saying, that means we have to kill them.
Today, Nehruz feels that her family is happy she's back here in the United States to have a good education and a bright future. They are blessed she is safe.
They don't have to worry about me dying or like being killed or suffering from, you know, like the bad life conditions. So they're kind of happy. I mean, they don't want me to go back after that year.
There are at least 130 immigrated Syrians, like Nehruz, living in West Virginia. Her wish is to reunite with her family, although she feels it's unsafe to go to Syria. Last spring, she tried to bring her mom to the U.S. for her graduation, but her mom's travel visa was denied. They haven't seen each other in almost 4 years.
It's different when you're away and you don't know what's going on. Exactly. It's really hard because you start imagining things and you would think, oh, probably you will always imagine the worst.
Nehruz and her mother are exploring options to meet next summer in Turkey or in Germany just so they could meet face to face. Meanwhile, Nehruz's long-term plan is to stay here in West Virginia to fight a different war against cancer. With her bachelor's degree under her belt, she will continue her research to find the cure for cancer. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ikram Benaisha in Charleston.
The debate over Syrian refugees is in full swing across the country, and both sides were represented on a recent episode of the Front Porch podcast. In a minute, we'll hear from former West Virginia Representative John Ellum, a state Republican of Syrian descent, who wants to welcome more refugees. But first, state Republican delegate Joshua Nelson told us why he sponsored a petition to keep refugees out until more safeguards are in place.
The petition has, from my understanding, is a little over 15,000 signatures to this point, and well over 40 delegates have signed on in support of it as well. Basically, what we're asking the governor to do is to stand up for West Virginians until we are absolutely certain that the process of vetting refugees is concrete, that we don't allow somebody to slip through the system that will harm West Virginians. In no way are we trying to not reach out and help the world. West Virginia has always done that. But at the same time, we want to make sure the home front's safe.
Delegate Nelson, as I understand it, the process as it now stands requires registration with the United Nations, an interview by the UN. They have to be granted refugee status, then referred to the United States, then interviewed by people with the State Department. Then there are several background checks and then several fingerprint screenings has to be reviewed a number of times. There's an interview. There's some education required. There's medical screening, cultural orientation, multi-agency security check. I mean, it seems like it's a pretty thorough process right now. People come to this country in shipping containers, too, is the other.
Right. Yeah, that's a concern. But I'll tell you this much. I have a top-secret security clearance from other job, and that process, for me, an American citizen, took well over 6 months. And we're talking, the process that you have just described are supposed to be completed by the end of the next fiscal year for 10,000 people. That's quite an undertaking in order for all that to be completed before we bring them here.
Delegate Nelson, some Republican presidential candidates have made a distinction between accepting Christian refugees versus refugees of the Muslim faith. Do you think that makes a difference one way or the other to you?
No, not at all. I mean, I think all refugees should go through the same process. And I don't think that we can do that. I mean, I don't think that is the proper way to go about it, is differentiating between what faith they particularly have.
So I just have one final question, Delegate.
Sure.
On one hand, I don't think anyone can argue about your concerns and a lot of our concerns about safety. On the other hand, very similar arguments about a fear of Nazis infiltrating refugees coming into America were used to severely limit the number of Jews that were fleeing Europe and Germany before World War II. And because of that, many of them got trapped and ended up dying in the Holocaust. I mean, there is a cost to keeping ourselves safe, which might be some refugees end up becoming victims. How do you respond to that?
You know, that's a very much a concern. And because of the fact that America is exceptional, we have some obligation to help out the rest of the world. But at the same time, again, people from these parts of the world have caused a lot of havoc to the rest of the world. And I want to reiterate that, by and large, most people in that area just want to live peaceful lives. I've served with Middle Eastern people, Islamic people, that had my back. But what, you know, in regards to what happened in Paris, you know, these guys are posing as Syrian refugees. And until we are certain that process is adequate, we have to be very careful.
Delegate Nelson, thank you for being here.
Thanks for allowing me to come on your show. I really appreciate it.
We're talking about whether West Virginia should be accepting Syrian refugees, and if so, under what conditions. And we have a special guest, former Delegate John Ellum. He's a Republican in Wood County and now in private practice. And also, we should say, you have background that's very important to this story, right?
That's correct. I am Syrian and Lebanese. My four grandparents, three of them were born and came from Syria, and one was born in Lebanon but lived most of her life in Syria.
You are taking a different tack than a lot of your fellow Republicans, at least in the House of Delegates, who have signed a petition saying that we should not be accepting Syrian refugees at this time. You think we should. Why?
I started an interest in the refugee issue several months ago, even before the horrific attacks in Paris. And actually, I've got to give credit to my wife, who is not of Syrian ancestry but loves the culture. And she and I were talking a couple of months ago about, we have this large house, and, you know, it would be nice to take in a Syrian refugee family. And from there, I started getting involved with others.
I have a question, Mr. Ellum. What kind of advice or what would you say to some of your former colleagues who are taking a different tack on this?
Fear, it can be a powerful emotion. it can cause you, if you're not careful, to act emotionally rather than rationally. And when you do that, you start collectively labeling people. You know, well, Syrians are all ISIS. No, Syrians are not all ISIS. They're the victims of ISIS. They're fleeing ISIS. They're the victims of terrorism. You know, certainly we want security, but don't let fear overwhelm you and cause you to act and lead from an emotional basis rather than a rational basis.
Former Delegate John Ellum, Republican from Wood County, is actively working to bring Syrian refugees into our state and is of Syrian descent himself. Mr. Ellum, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate this.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
That was Scott Finn, host and producer of The Front Porch. We've posted a link where you can hear more episodes of The Front Porch on our website at wvpublic.org. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. You know, it's not just war that forces people to migrate to a new home. We'll hear more about that from another episode of The Front Porch in just a bit. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. So because on our show today we've been talking about immigration into Appalachia, we wanted to feature a town that was settled entirely by immigrants from another country. So can you name a town in Appalachia that takes its name from Switzerland? Is it Suisse, Tennessee, Helvetia, West Virginia, or Svizzera, South Carolina? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So, what town in Randolph County, West Virginia, takes its name from Switzerland? If you guessed Helvetia, then you're correct. Helvetia is another word for Switzerland. Heidi Arnett and her family own Hutte Restaurant in this small town of just over 50 residents. Heidi's mother, Eleanor Mayhew, started the restaurant back in the 60s.
Ella Bettler was one of the first cooks here in Helvetia, and she's definitely all Swiss. And so a lot of the Swiss recipes were from family recipes in the area. And they just wanted to create something so that the children coming up would have a sense of their history.
Heidi says her mother, Eleanor, who passed away in 2011, was inspired to open the Hutte to help promote tourism to her community. She had gone away to serve in the American Red Cross during World War II. And when she moved back to West Virginia, Heidi says her mother had a vision.
My mother loves Helvetia, and when she came back, she really wanted to kind of bring back some of the old recipes and the old customs, because there was no business as far as, there was a little store, general store here. She wanted to create something that people could come to and kind of pull back, like the folk dancing had kind of died down. They used to folk dance, the Swiss dancing, but it had kind of died down, and so she was trying to bring back a heritage type thing.
And of course, today, the square dancing in Helvetia still goes on regularly. They have an annual Swiss festival in the fall, the ramp supper in the spring, and the local Swiss restaurant that Heidi and her family run is open year-round. And yes, they do have homemade bratwurst, sauerkraut, applesauce, and peach cobbler. If you have another story about Helvetia or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. We started today's show with a story from a young woman named Nehruz, who immigrated to Appalachia from Syria. She came here before the Syrian Civil War to attend college. Now, 5 years after the conflict began, she worries if she'll ever be able to see her mother again. She says West Virginia has become her home away from home. So far, her mother is staying put in Syria. But thousands of Syrians have been driven from their homes by the civil war there, and it's not clear where they'll wind up. We haven't had a similar situation here in the U.S. for many years, where war led Americans to pull up stakes and hope to find shelter elsewhere. But it hasn't been so long since we had a natural disaster that uprooted more than 500,000 people. 10 years ago, Hurricane Katrina forced Jennifer Hill and her mother to flee New Orleans. They found open arms in Huntington, West Virginia. Again, we're going to hear an episode of the Front Porch Podcast. Hill tells co-host Rick Wilson and Laura Lynn the fascinating story of a random flight to West Virginia and why she's stayed here ever since.
Jennifer, before we talk about how you ended up here in West Virginia, yes. I think Rick and I are very interested to hear what your experience was like 10 years ago. You ended up in the Superdome. Can you just kind of walk us through how that happened?
Sure. I love to tell the story. My mom, for some reason, was at my apartment, which usually meant I got a good dinner. And so I was excited about that. And she looks at me because she'd been watching the news. And she turns to me and she says, "It seems worse this time. What do you think?" And I was exhausted. And I was also a little bit anxious and nervous. And I didn't know what to do. So I said, "Turn the television off. Just turn it off. We know what they're going to say. You know, they always say it. They said it the last time and all we had was a couple leaves blow off the porch and we had a little bit of rain hitting the window panes. You know what? Let's just not worry about it right now." So that was Friday afternoon and I put myself to sleep Friday. And I think that's utter denial, although there was like this nagging pit feeling in the pit of my stomach. Saturday morning was when the panic maybe started to really set in. And looking at my mom and my brother and she's like, what do you think? And I'm like, "I don't think we can stay here." Now, it's 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, and I'm thinking, what other options do we have? But I don't think we could stay here. And my fear was, with those winds in a wood frame house, it would just blow us apart. So I was like, well, they had said because of mandatory evacuation, the Superdome was now opening as the last resort if you had nowhere else to go. And literally, it was walking distance from our apartment because I didn't live that far from the central business district. So I said, let's just pack a few things and we'll head up there. And it's a safer building. It's stronger. It's going to last. And this will blow over and it'll maybe be power outages, trees down, maybe a little bit of water. We assume some would happen. And then we'll be home probably by Monday night. So then we could hear, once it started blowing in about 4 o'clock, you started hearing things bursting and breaking. And the Hyatt Regency is connected to a plaza shopping center that's connected to the Superdome, and it's all glass. And so as the storm is hitting, every glass window is breaking. And so I to this day, if I hear glass breaking, it kind of sends a shiver through because we had to listen to that for hours. There was a parking garage underneath the Superdome. And as the winds whipped, they were so strong, they were starting to smash cars against concrete pillars. So you're hearing that. But as hard as that was to hear and as terrifying as that could have been, it was the ceiling peeling off the Superdome as the storm blew over us. And it was just a slow peel. It wasn't like ripping. It was just like you saw the split and then you saw it slowly starting to peel back.
So you could see from inside that it was peeling. Wow.
It was blown away. And then you could see water falling down. And it never was like a huge gaping hole in the ceiling. But what was the terrifying part of that was our city officials that were on the football field reacted to the peeling ceiling. And it was complete and utter panic. And, oh, my God. The ceiling's going, there's water coming in, and then we could hear it even in the stands, them saying, screaming, the generator is in the basement. And my thought was like, okay, we're below sea level. We've known this since the existence of the city. Why would you have built a basement, number one, and then why would you put the generators in the basement? So when that was said, maybe it was a good thing that I heard it. I prepared myself, and I even told my mom and my brother, I'm like, the lights are going to go out. I mean, we lost general power early on, probably when the winds first started, but the generators had kicked in. So we had minimal light, enough to see, enough to feel a little bit more comfortable. But when they said that, I'm like, all right, prepare for the worst now. And it did. It just went dark. That was scary. You could still hear the winds. You could still hear the glass breaking. You could still hear the cars. There were people that were starting to panic and freak out, if you want to say it. The Superdome population increased exponentially every day. And that was with the military branches rescuing people and bringing them there. there was such a huge amount of people that we had moved from the inside of the dome to the outside of the dome just to have some fresh air to breathe. And it was safer.
And there were stories about people running out of food and violence. And
The violence was there. And I don't want to stress it, but it was there even in the beginning. And I think it was just out of desperation. People just had no idea what was going on. And if there was a little bit of power to get a cell phone up and charged so they could tell somebody where they were, they'd fight for that right or fight for that privilege. I always say this to counter it. I saw the best in people and mm-hmm. I saw the worst in people. When we got out of the dome finally, there is a funny story that I call them funny stories. There are very interesting and nice stories in the midst of all this chaos and horror. And it actually goes back to why a lot of people probably didn't survive the storm. And that is, if you were a pet owner, or if you were elderly and didn't have a car, you were probably stuck wherever you were. And so there were a lot of people that would not leave their pets. And they would not just leave their homes at all because they didn't have cars like us. But a lady... in that last group of people getting off the bus had a beautiful, and I still remember him, absolutely gorgeous St. Bernard. Very docile, very friendly dog. And she looked at us and she said she'd walked from her apartment and gotten to the dome. And she's like, I'm not leaving him behind. And we'd heard them say, that dog's not getting on a bus. That dog's not getting on the bus. Well, our little group steadfast said, we like that dog. He became a fighting and rallying point for us. And we're like, that dog's getting on the bus. And she's like, how? They've already told me they're not. And she's like, if they don't let my dog, I'm not leaving the city. And so we said, I don't remember who in the group said it. He's your service dog. And we looked and we're like, huh? She's like, you're blind. He's your service dog.
I'm betting that was you.
You know what? In the delirium, it probably was me. And we came to the bus. We came up to the bus and the military guy came up. And the first thing he said was, that dog's not coming. And we looked at him and she's like, she's blind. She needs that dog. And there were so many of us screaming it at him that he just acquiesced and said, just go ahead. And she got on the bus and the dog and her got in the back and they just had the biggest grin. I swear the dog grinned too. I had the biggest grin. I don't know what happened to them once we got to the airport, but I was confident enough that we had saved that one little family. And that was a family. Yeah. That was her support. That was a moment that for the majority of the 12 hours, we had this one little guard that had been very nice to us and given us as much information as he could. And all I knew was my brother was in Texas. And if we got to Texas, we could reunite. And it was right before we boarded the plane that I asked the question, where in Texas will the plane land? Because I can figure out how to get to Dallas, where my brother was. And the guy looks, another military National Guardsman, I believe, said, this plane's not going to Texas. And I'm said, well, where is it going? And he said, it's going to West Virginia. And I say this, I was fully aware in 2005 that West Virginia was a separate state. I knew that through my own education and through my own experience that Louisiana and West Virginia shared quite a few characteristics that in the news, but I just didn't know where the airport was.
Had you ever been to the state?
I'd never been to the state. I never visited. And so we got on a C-130, I would say at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And so we landed at the Tri-State Airport. I remember it being extraordinarily cool morning. And after the awful, awful heat wave for that week, it felt so refreshing to feel that cold air. And I remember once we got in the ambulance, they started down the road from the airport to the hospital, and it's covered in green trees. And so that was my first experience of West Virginia, with a little bit of fog, a cool breeze, and a green trees. And I remember my mom being on the stretcher and saying, this doesn't look like a bad place, Jen. And I said, no, it doesn't. This actually is absolutely the best place for us. And it was positively the best place for us after that experience. I cannot tell you that once that plane landed in Huntington, the arms and the doors that opened to us and that made us feel welcome, that has made this my home for the past 10 years, and it is my home. And that was part of the decision even of not returning, because there was such a way made for those of us that landed here and opportunities that were offered, that was kind of the example set and the rest of the country could do the same. Because I would hear for months and months and months my friends saying, you know, I went to Arizona or I went to Virginia and they had all of their command stations set up and they understood. But for me, the first command station would have to have been outside of Texas, was West Virginia, because if I'm not mistaken, we were the first plane that did not go to Texas. That we were the first plane to go somewhere else, and it was here.
I knew the state was commended by the CDC after that for, you know, coordinated disaster response. So, again, we look pretty good on that one. Huh?
You look very, very good on that one. And I, like I said, I can't state it enough that it's the warmth and the culture here that was just the balm we needed.
Today on our program, we've been exploring stories of people who immigrated and migrated to Appalachia. But what about the Great Out Migration, often called a mass exodus of Appalachians to find work? Here in West Virginia, our population is aging due to the fact that many young people are leaving the state. The same is true and has been true for much of the coalfield since the 60s and 70s. Many Appalachians, maybe even you or your family, have moved to Baltimore, D.C., New York, and beyond for work or school. I had a few great uncles and their family who moved to Detroit to work in the auto industry, while another great uncle of mine and his family went south to Winston-Salem to work in the factories. And Chicago, Illinois has taken in its share of us Appalachians, too. This history was recently reported on in an episode of WBEZ's Curious City, as host Jesse Duke discovered Appalachians migrated to Chicago in search of jobs and a better life.
The biggest concentration was in Uptown, a north side neighborhood on the lake, just north of Irving Park. We recently got a question about them. It's from Matthew Bird, a college student in Iowa who grew up here.
I was wondering why so many migrants from Appalachia came to the Uptown neighborhood in the 50s and 60s, and I want to know why so many of them decided to go back home, down back south.
The question is personal. Matthew's grandparents were Appalachian migrants. They came here from West Virginia in the 60s.
And I always asked them why they all came to Uptown, and they could never give me a definitive answer. They're just like, oh, we came because we had a friend or what. I wanted to know why, like, they all came to that neighborhood. Why didn't they come to, I don't know, Bridgeport?
So Curious City put me, a recent Southern migrant myself, on the case. And we're going to break Matthew's question down into its elements. Why did so many Southerners come to Chicago? Why Uptown? And why did so many leave? Or did they leave? Along the way, we'll talk to scholars and activists, and we'll hear from Matthew's grandparents. You probably can guess why so many people came to Chicago. And in fact, Matthew could have gotten this one from his grandfather.
Well, I had relatives there. My wife's mother and father were there. They had offered to get me a job if I'd come up there.
Glenn Lambert says when he graduated high school in West Virginia in 1965, he knew what his options were.
Either go to work in a coal mine or work for minimum wage. That's my only choices I really had there. They're nothing but coal mines.
So it makes sense that Matthew Bird's grandfather would come north. But his was really the first generation to make that trip, even though the economy of Appalachia had been poor since well before the Civil War. So why didn't Southerners come north before that? Chad Berry is a historian who studied the Southern white migrations of the 20th century. He says until the 1920s, most big industrial employers in northern cities like Chicago and Detroit hired immigrants from overseas. But after World War I, the U.S. massively restricted immigration from other countries. So big business started looking domestically.
They looked in three places, white, blacks, and domestic-born Latino people.
At this point, some Southerners, white and black, did start migrating, but it was just a trickle, and the Great Depression put that on pause.
And then after World War II, this amazing demand for manufacturing. Chicago was a real magnet for workers, just as Detroit and Indianapolis and Cleveland and other countless places were in the Midwest.
By the 1960s, there were an estimated 30,000 white Southerners in Uptown. And they kept coming.
Migrants spoke of being able to leave a job and walk across the street and get another one.
This is Roger Guy, a sociologist who interviewed Southerners in Uptown in the 1990s.
Now we're talking about light industrial. For example, Polaroid and Zenith, and when they were just starting to produce, let's say, the Swinger?
Yep, the Swinger. Southerners also worked in carpentry shops, candy factories. When Matthew's grandfather showed up in 1969, there were still jobs.
I came to Chicago on Sunday. I went to S&C Electric Company on Monday morning, and I went to work Monday night on a night shift.
So, yeah, Southerners came for the abundant jobs. But Matthew also wanted to know why Uptown specifically. Roger Guy says everybody told him the same thing Matthew's grandparents said.
Everyone that you'd ask, they'd say, well, I had kin up there. I had kinfolk. I had a cousin. I had a sister.
Sure, makes sense. But somebody had to be the first to say, maybe we'll rent a place in Uptown. And we don't know who that was or even when exactly. But it is worth looking at what Uptown was before the 1950s.
In the 1920s, Uptown emerged as sort of a center district of entertainment with the Aragon Ballroom and the places like the Uptown Theater.
It was full of young professionals in swanky housing. Think The Great Gatsby, but set in the Middle West. But during the Depression, it went into a decline. The fancy people left, the nightlife got seedy, landlords couldn't find wealthy clients for their grand, beautiful apartments. They deferred maintenance to save money.
You just had a deterioration of housing stock, coupled with the desire to still make them profitable, and that led to them being divided and subdivided again.
So that by the late 1940s, you got a lot of tiny, cheap apartments, which was perfect for Southerners with jobs near the North Side and not a lot of cash. By the 1960s, Uptown had a nickname.
It sounds terrible now, but they still call it that. You know, they used to call Uptown Hillbilly Heaven.
This is Linda Lambert, Matthew's grandmother. Her family came to Chicago in 1965 after her father was injured in the coal mines.
We kind of got a little bit of a shock when we moved to Uptown because there were many, many Southern people there. But they weren't the Southern people that, like, we were used to being around. They were a little bit rough around the edges. You know, like if I would get ready to go to the store or something, my dad would watch me walk down the block because somebody would be whistling at me or something. And, you know, it was kind of upsetting. It was kind of scary a little bit.
Uptown still had a nightlife, but now it was country music in the bars. Many of the Southerners who came were that sort of young single men you might find at an oil boom town. You know, looking to work for a few weeks and then party.
Authorities are reluctant to point a finger at any one segment of the population or nationality group, but they agree that the Southern hillbilly migrants, who have descended on Chicago like a plague of locusts in the last few years...
This is from a series in the Chicago Tribune in the 50s. The first article was called Girl Reporter Visits Jungles of Hillbillies. And it was full of just nonsense, like this.
They get married one day, unmarried the next... And in the confusion of common law marriages, many children never know who their parents are, and nobody cares.
The Southerners did have a bad reputation, and I'm sure they still do in some areas. I don't think it's true. I think it's just like any other culture, you know, it's you got your good, you got your bad, you know. But there was a lot of poverty. That is true. But a lot of people lived there only until they could do better. You know, that was just a stop in the road.
Uptown went from Jazz Age Fancy District to, quote, Hillbilly Heaven, and then to something else. And Matthew's still wondering what happened to the Southerners during that last transition, because they're not in Uptown. That last phase began in the late 1960s as the abundant jobs started vanishing. Uptown's rough reputation got rougher, and the city and developers pushed for urban renewal. A former alderman there, Helen Schiller, remembers Uptown in the 70s and 80s.
City's policy generally, on the north side at least, was to create public works project in specific communities where they wanted to remove people, basically.
The developers and city officials said the development was necessary to revitalize the neighborhood, and that if people got displaced, that would be unfortunate, but, well... Sociologist Roger Guy says even if they didn't actively target the poor usually lost out. Uptown became contested space. One advocacy group proposed this, well, utopian mixed-use development called Hank Williams Village. They named it after the country singer. It would have an employment agency, a pharmacy, and affordable housing. It was one of several attempts to plan for development that would also accommodate the poor, including white Southerners.
But that wasn't what was happening. A handful of developers were redefining the community in real estate terms and claiming parts of it. They had deep pockets and bought up large tracts of family housing, kicked people out wholesale, and then tripled and sometimes even quadrupled the rent.
That's when, by many accounts, Southerners were priced out of Uptown and left Chicago altogether. Some went back south to the relatively bleak prospects of coal towns. Some looked for jobs in other industrial cities, like Detroit or Cleveland. And of course, some had left Uptown years before. Matthew's grandparents, the Lamberts, were shrewd, hardworking. But, and I think they'd agree with this, they were lucky, too. Glenn's job at SNC was stable and paid well. Linda worked, too. That allowed them to move to a shady street in Ravenswood, a nearby Northside neighborhood, raise kids, and eventually retire to Kentucky. And historian Chad Berry says there were a lot of people like that.
people who did find the economic dream they were looking for often moved on. And when they moved on, they might have bought a little brick tiny house in the suburbs. On one side was a Polish-American family. On the other side might have been a Lithuanian-American family. And right in the middle there was a Southern or Appalachian family.
Matthew and I take a visit to Truman College, which took out several blocks of housing when it was built and displaced thousands of Southerners. But it helped Southern families, too.
No, exactly. Like my mom got a nursing degree from Truman College, and that's one of the reasons I can go to college because of that. So
the campus is green and airy, and from the top floor of the parking deck, you can look out on the busy uptown streets and imagine how it once looked.
When you're up here and you're looking at it and you're seeing all these people, like, it's a really beautiful thing. And the fact that people from, like, a part of the nation that was very kind of poor and kind of isolated came up here and made a life for themselves and made a life for their children. That's the hope of the city. It's not just their story. It's, like, Chicago's story.
But he also feels that for the people who were pushed out of Uptown, Chicago let them down.
There's success and there's failure. And I think the failure means that the next time a large group of people from, like, a part of the country or part of the world that's kind of maligned comes here, just do by them better than we did by, you know, the people from Appalachia or the people from Poland or Africa or Vietnam, to do better by them.
Reporting this week came from me, Jesse Dukes, and we had more than a little help from Matthew Bird and his family. Thanks to the Chicago History Museum for sharing their archives.
That was Jesse Dukes, producer of Curious City. That episode first aired back in April. It's a show by WBEZ in Chicago, Illinois, that takes questions about Chicago, the region, and its people. For more episodes, you can check out wbez.org/curiouscity. As you probably know, we Appalachians have been underestimated for years. A 2013 report by the University of Dayton Law Review pointed out popular culture is flooded with negative stereotypes about persons from Appalachia, which enables society to view their entire existence with scorn. The report referred to this type of discrimination as Appalachiaism. Huh, it has a name. The report went on to say, yet despite the ever-expanding forms of discrimination that are acknowledged today, Appalachiaism remains unrecognized as a form of discrimination in our current society. But back in 1993, Cincinnati, Ohio, became the first city in the nation to include people of Appalachian descent in its anti-discrimination ordinance. Thanks for listening to our stories about immigration, migration, and Appalachia. It's a place so personal that even after folks move away, they still call it home.
The skies are taller in Louisiana, the skies are wider in New Mexico, the skies in Texas kind of split the difference, that don't suit me no matter where I go. I ain't got a place in this world, I ain't got a place in this world, I know.
Oh, wait. Before you go, we wanted to share a good cheesy story for our occasional segment called Appetite Appalachia, where we explore the foods and recipes found throughout our region with Appalachian flavor.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table, eating beans and making love as long as I am able.
So last time for Appetite Appalachia, we talked about some of the signature foods from across Appalachia. Barbecue from North Carolina, pepperoni rolls from West Virginia. But did you know that for some South Carolinians, a special type of blue cheese is their local signature food? On a recent swing through Pickens County, food writer Fred Sossman learned the story.
The tiger is a Clemson University icon, and so is blue cheese. The university has been making it since 1941. Watson Dorn, a dairy farmer from Edgefield, South Carolina, now manages the production and distribution of Clemson blue cheese with his wife, Lisa.
In 1940, Dr. Paul Miller, a professor in the dairy science department here at Clemson, discovered that the Stump House Tunnel, which is kind of synonymous with Clemson blue cheese, had the perfect humidity and temperature, everything he needed to age blue cheese.
Stumphouse Tunnel is an unfinished pre-Civil War railroad tunnel cut into the face of Stumphouse Mountain. The cheese was made on the Clemson campus and then carried to the tunnel about 20 miles away and aged for 6 months.
The original tunnel that Clemson aged their blue cheese in is located north of the town of Walhalla on Highway 28, and it's actually a tourist destination now.
When Clemson University built Newman Hall in 1956, everything transitioned from Stumphouse Tunnel to the university for the aging process, and it's been there ever since. Clemson managed the blue cheese operation until 1997, when it was turned over to the Aramark Corporation. When the future of the cheese became uncertain, Clemson approached Watson Dorn, who milks Holstein cows at Hickory Hill Farm, and placed the cheese back under university control.
The milk comes from our farm. We're located about 82 miles from here. It's a little bit different. We pasteurize at a low temperature that preserves all the good bacteria that naturally occurs in milk, but we don't homogenize the milk. So it's the old-fashioned cream-lined milk. A lot of older customers are used to the cream rising to the top, and you have to shake the milk up. We sell our milk in 3 states. We started using our milk for production of Clemson blue cheese, knowing it was a different type of milk than what Aramark had been using. We got with a consultant. His name is Neville McNaughton. Neville's originally from New Zealand, and he has got a passion for cheese making. He actually judges a lot of the World Cheese Contest, and he lives in St. Louis now. So Neville taught us how to make cheese, good quality Clemson blue cheese that would represent the university well with non-homogenized milk.
Anthony Pounders is the man who takes the milk from those Holstein cows and converts it into Clemson blue cheese. He started out milking cows at the university. When he was chosen to be cheesemaker, he says he ruined 22 vats of cheese before seeking the wisdom of a veteran who taught him the craft.
I told the Aramark Corporation, I said, I've got more pride than y'all got money. I said, I got to go talk to this old cheesemaker and see if he'll come back and teach me. I said, because I can't do it just by throwing me into the fire like this. I mean, he said, if you care enough to come to my door not knowing who I am, he said, yeah. He said, I'll come back and I'll teach you. Not a whole classroom of people. It's going to be one-on-one, me and you.
That veteran cheesemaker was John Whitmire, and he turned out to be a talented teacher. Clemson blue cheese is now experiencing a resurgence all across South Carolina and beyond. Learning to make, package, and market the cheese is part of the curriculum at Clemson for students like Patrice Newsom from Chicago, Illinois.
I help package the blue cheese for Clemson blue cheese. My goal with food science technology is to go into quality assurance. So working in blue cheese, I've seen some quality aspects. One of my coworkers, she actually went to a cheese tasting competition that Clemson blue cheese was entered in, and she came back and talked about the scoring of the cheese. So it gave me like a quality perspective to see the marks that we got and to see like where we need to improve on the cheese.
It is an artisan product. Every lot is different. Every batch that we do is just a little bit different.
It's an art. You have to feel the curds to know exactly when it's time to actually start hooping.
My professors would be on me if they heard this description, because they're like really picky about how we describe food. But the first thing I would say is this is better than any other blue cheese I've tasted.
It's really not as strong as a lot of the other blue cheeses that's sold out there on the market today.
Many restaurants in upstate South Carolina, including Pixie and Bill's in Clemson, swear by the university's famous blue cheese.
A lot of people love blue cheese salad dressing, but they're not necessarily connoisseurs of blue cheese that's straight by itself. I've noticed in a lot of restaurants that there are a lot of recipes where they're putting it on top of a really prime cut of steak.
I like to mix it in a hamburger. When you make hamburger, I also take the crumbles and put it on a hot dog.
No matter how it's served, there's one thing that the Clemson blue cheese makers insist on, and that's the American spelling of the word.
Yeah, there's one of our better retail locations. I passed by there, and it happens to be owned by a friend of mine, and I passed by his marquee, and he had on the marquee, "We now sell Clemson blue cheese," and he had spelt it B-L-E-U. And I called him and I said, "Look, that's the European version. We spell it B-L-U-E.
For Inside Appalachia, on the campus of Clemson University in South Carolina, I'm Fred Sausman.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WBEZ's Curious City and the Front Porch Podcast. Music in today's show was also provided by Ben Townsend, Little Sparrow, Jake Sheps, Andy Agnew Jr., and James McMurtry with "I Ain't Got a Place," as performed on Mountain Stage. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. Our audio mixer is Scotty White. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
A river runs east out of West Virginia. Rivers run west down in Tennessee. A river runs north out of South Dakota. None of that makes a damn to me. I ain't got a place. I ain't got a place in this world. I ain't got a place. I ain't got a place in this world, I know. You ask me where I'm coming from, I'm not sure I can say. You ask me where I'm headed, I'll just grin. You don't ask too many questions, I'll be coming back to stay. You know not to ask me where I've been. So I'm looking up at a constellation, looking down at the frozen ground, looking out for all my interests, looking in just brings me down. I ain't got a place. I ain't got a place in this world. I ain't got a place. I ain't got a place in this world. You know I ain't got a place. I ain't got a place in this world. I ain't got a place in this world, I know.